The Education Committee will reconvene. Our next item is Senate File 3250, Senator Rummel.
I'm going to invite my testifiers to come to the table with me.
Okay, welcome everyone.
I feel like I'm talking to you down this long distance, and we've got the weight down here at this end of the room. Mr. Chair and members, I'm pleased to introduce Senate File 3250. And before we do that, I'd like to offer Amendment A1, which puts the bill in the order that suits what we're trying to achieve.
Okay, Senator Rummel offers the A1 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Yes, I can vote.
Carry.
Okay.
Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chair and members, wherever you are, this is a really important bill. We call it the World Class Education Act. And as we heard from testimony earlier this afternoon, setting forth a vision for education in Minnesota is a really important thing for this legislature to do. First of all, this bill creates a coherent system of education. And if I could quote from page 5 of the Minnesota Promise document that everyone has received, it says, a guiding premise for Minnesota's promise is that if our state is to provide all students with a world-class education, we must create an education system that is coherent from the capital to the classroom. In such a system, every level must have a clear understanding of the role it plays in helping all students succeed. And in a nutshell, that is what this bill sets out to do. It focuses our education community on 10 essential elements of high-performing system, and it recognizes the 3 major levels of responsibility that need to work together to make change happen. The first part of the bill adds to the mission a vision of what the task of our education system is. And then the second part of the bill sets up a working group to help us pace this mission into reality. And I'm going to leave it to my testifiers to give you some of the history and the significance of this bill. So first I'll turn the microphone over to Mr. Charlie Kite.
Okay. Welcome back.
Charlie? Senator Wieger, thank you very much for having us here. I am going to be very brief. I had the opportunity, I think it was last Friday, to make a presentation in general about this right here in this room. And you heard the presentation, as did others. And so I'm going to try to just be careful with our time. The point, though, I would like to make is that each of the 10 strategies identified in this bill are identified in ways in which the state policymakers could address some of the issue, ways in which school districts could address the issue, and the way in which schools could address the issue. And to that end, we asked 2 of our school superintendents in Minnesota to come in and to speak a little bit about what they're doing right now to try to make sure that their communities are using Minnesota's promise, this report, in a way that actually drives their education systems forward. So with that, I think the best thing that I could do right now is to simply introduce Superintendent Keith Ruskowski of Stillwater and Superintendent Deb Henton of North Branch, and let them share with you what it is they're doing.
Very good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. My name is Keith Ruskowski. I'm superintendent in Stillwater Area Public Schools. And thank you for inviting us here tonight to talk a little bit about Minnesota's promise. I'd like to just briefly share with you how I've used the information in our district to communicate with our community over the past 18 months. As you're aware, that this document has really focused on the work that's been going on initially with a group of superintendents and then now other education organizations over the last 3 years. And beginning 18 months ago, I started to capture some of the large messages about setting a vision for Minnesota into my communications with the community. And I have the opportunity to share weekly columns with the community on various aspects of education. And I've tried to hit on the different parts of the Minnesota's promise from the standpoint of trying to focus to people that we're really faced with an issue where it's about all children. I heard testimony earlier this afternoon, and we're currently looking at today's kindergarten class as a class of 2020. And that's really a daunting situation, because as we think about that time and what is that world that the children are going to be out for, and I think we would agree that it's something different education-wise than what we had, and what are we going to do to prepare them for that. And part of my message is not necessarily about what are we necessarily going to do in our school district in Stillwater, but what are we going to do in Stillwater and what will we support on a statewide basis for all children in all school districts. Because unless we have a comprehensive look at improving the education quality for all the students in our district, what we necessarily happen to do in Stillwater isn't going to make the major impact that we want for all of our students. This has led to great conversation between and among community members and community organizations about what are the priorities that they see for education, and it's also helped them to start to understand and verbalize some of the changes that are facing not only in the world when students leave, but also in preparing students for that world. And so I've really used this to help foster that type of communication. We're using it as we revise our strategic plan, and with that, I'm going to hand it off to Superintendent Deb Hinton, because she's a little further along with that process and can tell you how she's making use of it in her district.
Thank you, Mr. Rakowski. Senator Wigger and members of the committee, I am very pleased to be able to be here tonight and tell you about what an important tool this has been for me as I have gone through strategic planning process. Just a very brief history of my career so that you have an understanding of where I've been and how this has really helped me with my work. I have
been Superintendent, please state your name for the
recording.
Yes,
I'm so sorry. I'm Deb Hinton, Superintendent of North Branch Schools, and I have worked in the urban setting and the suburban setting and now a semi-rural setting. I've worked in South Washington County, St. Paul, and Stillwater, and now North Branch. In St. Paul, I was responsible for strategic planning for the last 2 years. I did not have this document to help guide my planning in St. Paul. Dr. Maria Karstarfen talked to you a little bit about her strategic plan today, and I am here to talk to you about how Minnesota's Promise has helped me with the strategic planning I'm now doing in North Branch. What I see this doing is providing essential elements that we can use and look at and create consistency across the state, whether you're in urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. All of the elements that are mentioned here, the 10 elements, give you flexibility but are the big umbrellas under which every district should be planning. And so there's great potential for all of our kids across the state if the superintendents use this document. And I can tell you from my experience that I find more superintendents looking to this document for guidance rather than fewer. As Mr. Ruskoski said, he's using it. I've used it and looked at it as I've developed a strategic plan in North Branch. I can tell you the superintendents in Region 6 in which I work are looking at this as well. It affirms what we currently do and helps guide us. It gives us a vision for the future. And again, consistency is really important. It also allows flexibility at the local level. We have some, again, big elements that we can look at and focus on, but we don't have to do exactly every action step, which is listed underneath. Those are only examples and options. So it gives me also a sense of optimism to know that we have created work that can be done at the state level, at the district level, and at the school level. So with that, I thank you very much for allowing the opportunity to testify before you about the Minnesota's Promise.
Thank you, Superintendent. Mr. Kite.
I'm going to turn this back over to Mr. Kite.
Senator Wigger and members of the committee, we wanted to let you know that we are actively pursuing an improvement strategy all over the state. It only now occurred to me that as Superintendent Ruskoski is from the Senator Saltzman's district, but actually Deb Hinton, well before she was a superintendent, was also there from that district. But I can also let you know that up in Fergus Falls, they're using this document as their strategic planning guide. I can tell you that in Isle, Minnesota, Superintendent Alan Ralston is writing articles regularly into their press in that area, and I could go on and on. Part of the reason that we're hoping that this set of ideas comes into statute is that it gives us a mechanism and gives you a mechanism to keep this alive for a long time, and therefore allows teachers, principals, superintendents, and state policymakers, as well as parents, to keep concentrating on these ideas so that we can really work with a long-term improvement policy. Senator Rummel, Kent Bickel is here, and he has some visitors with him. I don't know if he was going to introduce them or not, but maybe we could do that if that's possible.
Mr. Chair,
welcome back.
Senator Rummel, my son Adam, age 7, in St. Paul Schools, and my daughter Victoria are over there, and she has not declared her candidacy yet, but she said when she walked into the Capitol, "This place is beautiful. I want to live here." So,
Daddy lives here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true, sir.
Welcome, Adam and Victoria.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. A number of you heard me last week. We talked about the strategy that the United Kingdom has put in place to invest in teacher quality. We talked about the strategy that Massachusetts has put in place to invest in standards and assessments. And the takeaway from those examples is there are many ways to get at high performance, but getting at high performance requires focusing on a way. And it requires sustaining that strategy over changes in leadership at the district level, at the school level, and at the state level. And so Minnesota's Promise, we believe, gives Minnesota a framework for long-term thinking. It doesn't make the decisions, but it sets some priorities, and we believe that over time we can drill down to implementation. Very briefly, what are the components of high performance that we looked at, starting with 27 superintendents and extending to 500 people who contributed to this? There's a test called the PISA test, the Program for International Student Assessment. It's given by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, the International Club of Developed Nations. And it tests our 15-year-olds across the world, not just on their ability to understand academic content, but to apply it. So it's applied learning at the end of K-12. And the top scoring nations in the world in reading, math, and science, of which the United States is currently not one, all take this kind of systemic approach to education. And there are two separate research studies that have looked at the top scoring nations of PISA, and I can summarize their conclusions very briefly in a few bullets. The OECD's own research has found that the top scoring nations have three things in common. Number one, high challenge. Number two, high support. And number three, aligned incentives. High challenge meaning every student is pushed beyond where he or she feels comfortable. High support, meaning not just that they're pushed to stretch, but that they're provided with the resources and interventions they need to succeed, and aligned incentives. And, Mr. Chair, you have been, of course, a strong advocate for aligning one of our most important incentives in K-12 and higher education. So that's one route to high performance. And a second is some research that McKinsey and Company has done on the same test. And they found three other components. Number one, you get the absolutely most talented people in your country into the classroom. Number two, you continually improve their instructional ability. And number three, you make sure every student has access to that extraordinary teaching. So there's a growing sense around the world of what high performance means. We think Minnesota's Promise gives us a framework for thinking about high performance in Minnesota. But again, the main takeaway is that without a strategy that is embraced across the aisle here and across districts and cultural communities, high performance is going to be beyond our reach in the coming decades. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Saltzman, followed by Senator Alcine.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to welcome Superintendent Ruskoski to this room tonight, and I wish we had our community here to hear you talk about this, because you have been out in front of this, and I have a copy of your column that you wrote. I don't know if we can pass that out to the members, but it sure. was extremely well written and really focused on, I think, what we talked about earlier, that we all have to be part of this discussion and who owns the vision, and you said we all do. So I think when I look at this bill, Senator Rummel, the one thing that comes to mind was, I think we had this discussion in E-12 just last week, is that I really like the fact that there's a place for us in terms of the legislature to start to carry out the mission. And to improve that, that we as a legislator need to start to pursue policies and school finance reforms based on the following goals. And the one piece I would like to suggest would make this even stronger is if we did that in conjunction with our business community. And I think we've had that discussion. But to me, that would really strengthen this continue to build that relationship. I know that Dr. Kite also is working on that. Just one more note. I recently attended, or this last fall, went to a workshop at the U of M, and that speaker came in from Chicago to talk about the workforce crisis. And there were many different people there, and when we stood up to leave, my superintendent was there and I was there. And it was sort of like this sense of maybe we get it in Stillwater, although we have work to do with our community on this. But I think that there's certainly a vision, and whatever we can do at this table to push that we need to have some mutual goals, and that we need to work with the stakeholders, and that our schools should not be alone in this. We need to bring in those other people as well. So it's not a question. That's just a couple comments and statements.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. I do believe that the business community did participate in framing the Minnesota Promise. One of the things that I noticed when I read the turnaround plan from Massachusetts is they created this triangle. And on one hand, they were asking for the high standards, the high expectations for students. On the second side of the triangle, they had the professional caliber of the teachers, but the base of the triangle was the collaboration between the community and the school. So I think that's a point well taken.
Senator Olsen.
I have to do a plug also for North Branch Schools and Superintendent Hatton. That board is very near and dear to my heart, having served on it for 10 years, and I'm glad to see the leadership of Ms. Henton on there now. And I've been involved in some of their visioning processes in the last few weeks. But the statement made by, is it Mr. Peckel? Close enough? that we're beyond our reach. That's a pretty dramatic statement that you ended your testimony with. Could you maybe go into a little more on some of the ramifications if we don't address that? You know, beyond our reach, I think, is something that maybe more people need to hear if we stay maybe on a path that we're already on.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I appreciate your catching the gravity of that term. It wasn't used loosely. You know better than anybody, in dealing with the issues you do here at the legislature, the stakes that we're in a knowledge economy, and that individual employers face and that our state as a whole faces. You can find dramatically different approaches to educational improvement, but you will not find a single high-performing system that gets there by accident, that gets there without a coherent strategy, and sticks to it over time. And so there are many roads to the destination, but it's very clear that an emphasis, for instance, on what has gone by the term local control, which sometimes means local control and sometimes means the absence of coordination and reinventing the wheel across the state, has very high consequences for us. Let me highlight one example of that, if I may. The Minnesota Principals Academy has been a bipartisan effort. The governor and the commissioner have been highly supportive. It was created with an initial state appropriation, and we're hopeful that some resources will be there. In the year and a half I've been at the university running that program, which brings our school leaders together for 2 or 3 days a month to look at research and taking their schools to high performance, the degree to which, if we don't do something like that on a statewide basis, we can't do it well, has dumbfounded me. I was with President Brunix 2 weeks ago on the Iron Range. We were across the state asking every school or district and charter school to provide high-quality leadership development for their school leaders is antithetical to high performance. We're reinventing the wheel, and we're not using resources effectively across the state. That's the kind of effort that we can do where we have economies of scale and we can bring people together. It also has educational benefits because, for once, we're not talking within our sandboxes. We're talking about literacy across rural, urban, suburban, charter school, district divides. We're talking about how you ramp kids up in reading and helping our school leaders create an understanding of how they do that. So if we as a state are not willing to look for strategies like the Principals Academy, and that's just one example, we're going to leave it to these two great superintendents to come up with that on their own in the midst of everything else they need to do. So that's an example of how we can begin to move toward that. And a growing body of research would tell us that investing in our leaders is a very cost-effective way to get at a lot of the other things that we're looking at doing.
Thank you.
A follow-up?
Senator Olsen.
And this could be to anyone on the panel. Is this kind of a throw the baby out with the bathwater? Or, I mean, are you seeing some parts of our system that are very good and we don't need to overhaul, but I almost get the impression that we almost need to start over, and I don't know if it's that dramatic, but I kind of get that feeling.
Mr. Chair, in fact, if I had to say, as one of the people who's worked on this effort, my greater concern was that people would open this report and say it's the same old. I've seen all of this before. So I would say definitively it is not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's sustaining and connecting the dots between the best practices that we often have in place that have rarely been taken to scale across even a school, much less a district, or sustained over time. So, no, it is definitively not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's investing in what we increasingly know works. That said, I think the sentiment that you articulate, that we have to start from ground zero and build it up, there's a growing drumbeat around the country toward that end, saying, let's just give up. Let's give up on the system. I think those of us who've been teachers or administrators, however, would know that we really have no choice but to reinvent the airplane while we're flying it, because there's kids in those classrooms and schools. And so that's what we need to do. So proposals to, quote, blow up the system, I think, are, for obvious reasons, not in the best interest of the state.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman.
Yes, just a follow-up thought in regard to the work that was done this last summer with our work groups is that I see these different areas, and I see a work group to sort of monitor the progress, but I think what I saw happen this last summer and fall with the Senate work groups being assigned to different topics, there became champions or sort of legislative experts on many of these topics. So just a thought to think about is that should we move forward with this initiative in some way to maybe coordinate with the House to put one work group in front of the seems very daunting. It's sort of like you're going to be hearing reports as opposed to maybe looking at working with the House on coordinated work groups, and certainly some of them are early childhood, some of them relate to data-driven decision-making, and maybe to look at, I think there's 10 different areas to maybe look at, are there 4, 5, or 6, or 8 areas that maybe it's to form work group, task force, whatever, because I think you need legislative leaders who understand, who truly see and can see opportunities. And that may be a way to further this. And, of course, we always have work groups, and there seems to be a cost with that. But I think if you look at it that way, of perhaps, like, you know, some overlapping groups, because I see what happened in early childhood. I see what happened with our literacy. I see what happened with Senator Rummel's work group and Senator Torres-Ray, that people really got into the meat. We went out, we talked, and we sort of saw what was working. I think that's what you want here is sort of a think tank of what's working and what are barriers. I think along the way we need to always look at what's preventing us from doing these kind of things, not just, you know, the good programs, but what kind of policies do we need. So just some thought to maybe make this more of an action plan than a group that it meets and like we see like reports. So just some thoughts.
Yes, Mr.
Senator Wieger and members of the committee. I think that's a great observation. In Section 2, we really try to set out a working group that is cross-party and cross-Senate, House, and Governor, and Commissioner, and some members of the public that would actually come together annually. And our hope is that they would engage in a discussion that would lead all of the parties to maybe come together around two or three of the strategies that they really want to concentrate on. And then as each goes on their respective ways, they start working on the same thing rather than everybody working on something different. And I think Senator Saltzman earlier suggested that if we could find a way to bring some involvement of the business community into that group as well, I think that that would be a strengthening piece to this whole thing. But our hope is that as a state, we will start to concentrate our effort just a little bit. And if we do it over time, we can really get to quite a number of these areas. We just can't get them all done at once. And if we all try to work on different things at the same time, we really don't advance the ball very far down the field. So I think that's a great observation.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the committee? Yes, Dr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Dr. Karen Efron, Ed Watch. As with Senator Torres' Raise bill and the P20 Council bill and the Office of Early Childhood Education bill and all the other ones that are floating around, the ideas focused on, except for the idea of increased academic rigor, are either not effective, cause academic or emotional harm, or an invasion of privacy, an abrogation of parental rights and responsibilities, or are not the role of government, besides being very expensive. So, again, we would recommend focusing on academic rigor, such as the intensive phonics bill that Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson are working on, doing integrated, or not doing integrated math, but rather doing traditional math, because integrated math has been shown not to adequately prepare Minnesota students to do college math. Focus on what really does erase the achievement gap, which is basically strong families, intact families, and religiosity. And I'm not asking the government to be involved in religiosity, just to not undermine families with policies. For instance, instead of allowing no-fault divorce, eliminating that, and not penalizing paternal involvement in welfare policies. And I would just recommend to the committee looking at William Jane's study from the University of California that studied 20,706 Black and Latino students and found that intact, those students from intact families that had active religious faith had no achievement gap with compared to white students. So I would recommend all of these commissions and programs and looking at that. And finally, withdrawing from No Child Left Behind, because the expense and the mandates and the federal interference are costing Minnesota gravely and are not producing results.
Thank you, Dr. Efram. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Efram, earlier in your testimony, I didn't question anything you said, but I just can't let it go. When you say no-fault divorce, intact families, you know, maybe we should make a bill that, you know, parents love each other the rest of their lives and support their kids forever. You know, things happen in life, and we can't do that. Families blow up for whatever reason. Problems happen, and there are kids left that need to make sure that they grow up and are educated the best way they can. So when you repeatedly testify to us about these things, it's like, there's a real world out there with real problems, and I don't see how your plans are going to address that.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, we're perhaps not going to solve anything in a debate on this, but a brief response.
Senator Olson, any more than the plans in these bills are right and proper for government to decide that children are mentally and physically and have the responsibility to make sure that children are mentally and physically ready to enter school or any of the other things in these. You have to look at the right and proper role of government. And I am not saying that government should mandate that everybody love each other and never divorce. But on the other hand, you have to look at the evidence of what works and what doesn't. And the things that are put in these bills do not work.
Okay, well, that's a matter of opinion. And is there anyone else that would like to testify before the committee? Anyone else? Okay, well, Senator Rummel, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems like one of the more difficult challenges is that, you know, where do you start? And, you know, I think ideally we'd all like to start on, you know, a whole host of things. But in reality, we probably don't have the resources, and we probably don't have the all of the horses in the right place to do it. If you were to, I mean, if you listen to the experts, they say, well, you should put your resources in early childhood, or you should, you know, put them, you know, one place or another. And we are going through some tough times ever since, you know, I'd say the early 2000. We've had fewer resources to really make an impact on some of these programs. If you had to choose, and sometimes I get the feeling that, you know, we're expecting way, way, way too much from our schools, and yet I know that that's probably the best anchor in our communities is our schools. I mean, they do socializing, they've got athletics, they teach our kids the academics, how to work with one another. I mean, they're just a broad, broad array of human activity that goes on there. But I think all of us realize that you can't change everything. What would you say, Senator Rummel, in terms of if you were to pick out a few key items, what would those be?
Sir Rummel.
I would like to refer to Mr. Pickell. I think he said the other day that sound funding for schools, early childhood education, and high expectations, but I'll let him speak because he can speak to it more authoritatively.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the short answer is where could you start? The research would suggest that the single biggest factor within a school is the quality and skill of the teacher. That's a very, very big ticket item to address, and Minnesota has a very major effort underway with the quality compensation effort and other things. I would submit that, as I suggested earlier, a very high impact and underutilized resource is investing in our school leaders. That investing in those principals or charter school directors is a very, very modest impact. But, I mean, I can tell you from my years in the classroom, the best thing you can give a good teacher is a really good principal. And so that is a very high impact. The research is even clearer, however, Senator, as Senator Rummel suggests, that an investment in early childhood is going to pay dividends throughout students' lives. And so that's another one. It is not something that comes at modest levels. And then an investment that I think our schools across the state are making, and that the state leadership and support for getting students who are underrepresented in our most rigorous coursework, students of color, low-income students, and students who are just in the academic middle, into our most challenging coursework, what used to be called the college prep track. We know we need to do it for obvious economic and academic reasons, but it also can change schools. It changes schools because you see kids who teachers and students themselves never thought they could do these things, doing them. And that begins, and if you've been in a school like that, where there's this expectation that every kid is, quote, college material, it has benefits across the educational continuum. So the immediate opportunity, I would say, is school leadership. The big picture is early childhood. And what we all need to continue working on is getting more Minnesota kids into our most challenging courses.
Mr. Chairman, on that last item, I think raising the expectation is probably is a very legitimate, good approach. But I think there's several kind of tangential issues. We know that there's such a thing as grade inflation. You know, from the time I first went through college till I went back into graduate school, I mean, a B, you kind of knew what a B was. Well, my gosh, now you get an A. Or if you had were a C, you get a B. I mean, it was just almost a night and day different approach. The other one is I think in the area of discipline, where the and some people think, well, we don't have the discipline. You've had to take the discipline out of the system because of a whole host of reasons. But discipline is an enormous benefit to individual achievement. If you can turn the TV off and sit down and read, you've disciplined yourself to achieve something. If you know you have activities that you have to do, and you lay those out and you get them done, that's an achievement. And I think we don't set up the environment for that kind of discipline like we used to. And I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, you should bring paddling back in or those kinds of things. But I that could be the structure of our system. There's not enough time for teachers to actually work with students. Lots of times the classes are squeezed into a period of time where, you know, you can almost hear one bell end when the next one rings. There's so many activities that are surrounding our schools that the students kind of feel like they're just kind of split up. So it seems to me that there's an inherent problem in the structure of schools too, and maybe a good leader, a good principal, would be able to ferret some of that out and maybe make some of those changes.
Mr. McKell.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I this is just by way of saying amen. I'll say certainly by way of agreeing with your analysis, at the University of Minnesota, one of the things, and I can't point to independent research that says this, but anecdotally, one of the things that we see in terms of our Minnesota students persisting to completion is not their academic preparation in some cases. It's these habits of persistence and discipline is a critical X that we need to work on. I will tell you that in the Minnesota Principals Academy, one of the core frames that we spend a year working with principals on is the both the philosophy and the research that says learning comes not from inherited aptitude, not what you bring into the classroom, but it's from effort. And that actually the only way you really change a student's trajectory is you show that student, him or herself, that effort produces results. And if you don't organize for effort, is the terminology we use, if you don't organize your classroom for effort and you don't organize your school for effort, you're absolutely right that the hidden messages and the explicit structural constraints of school, including bells that ring and shape learning when learning is right in hot and heavy, absolutely undermine effort. And so that really is the kind of paradigm shift that we're seeing, we're asking our schools to make. And helping our leaders guide that shift, to me, is a good place to invest our limited resources.
It comes to mind a couple of things. The governor in his State of the State, I believe, talked right up front on the role of the parents. And if you don't have that, a meaningful engagement, setting the climate at home, it's almost futile at school. and then I was reminded everyone should be watching the various presidential candidates, but check out Barack Obama's YouTube on his recent talk on discipline and telling parents to turn off the TV, to get your homework done, to eat breakfast, et cetera, and see what all the candidates are saying about that. But Senator Stumpf, you're exactly right. And we are going to have a special hearing after committee deadline on the role of the parent and talk about discipline and some of the applications that we've just had discussion on. That'll be in April. Is there anyone else that would like to address the committee? This does need to go to Senator Rest Committee and then back to the Education Finance Committee. So we'll entertain a motion. Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 3250 be re-referred to the Committee on
State and Local Government.
State and Local Government.
Okay. Further discussion. Well, thank you. Before we vote, Senator Rummel, to all of the people that have been involved in putting this document, various additions together, and I think there's been some additional advice as we proceed that I know is going to be factored in. And as well, this has been heard, the Minnesota Promise presentation in hundreds of communities throughout Minnesota. Through the superintendents and other stakeholders, but in my own school district where I live, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, it's been presented numerous times by Superintendent Patty Phillips, just like other testifiers have said why it's important to their district. We're trying to recognize what you have put together, and that is appreciated. There being no further discussion, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you. Next, we have the Department of Education bill. And I'll just ask the commissioner and her testifiers, they're going to present it. And there's also an author's amendment. And I wanted to see if the department had a chance to review that amendment. And you're in agreement with that? So to put the bill in the shape that we're discussing, I will move the amendment, which is labeled A.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's the A4 amendment.
Exception.
Yeah, I'll wait till that's confirmed as it's going out. Okay, I'll move the A4 amendment. All in favor indicate aye. Opposed? Carried. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for allowing us to share the department policy bill with you tonight. I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of the big picture things that are in the policy bill, and then we'll get into the details for you, just kind of give you an understanding of what's in there. There's certainly in Article 1 finance provisions that sometimes will be technical and sometimes are language that we needed to clarify from last year's bill that maybe didn't make the inclusion in last year's finance bill. In Article 1 and Article, there's finance provisions in Article 1. In Article 3, in Sections 3, there is another finance provision. In Article 5, there are some finance provisions, too, Articles 4 and 5. And then the other areas that are included are charter schools, and we have a number of sections that we're going to go over with you that are some clarifications and changes that we think need to be made to the charter school law that will clarify some existing language and things that we work on with charter schools.
Excuse me, Commissioner, I want to note that the A4 did have several provisions related to charters.
Yes,
which make sure the audience, as it's distributed at the table, that you're aware of what we're now considering.
And the
please
charter
proceed.
School language is in both Article 1 and in Article 2. In Article 1, they're in Sections 7, 8, and 9. And in Article 2, they're in Sections 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 21. And then there will be some amendment to that as we look at the amendment to our bill. There's also testing provisions in the bill. And those are in Article 2 in Sections 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. just to give you a heads up on that. And then we have some other provisions that are a mix of various things that we'll go over with you as we get to them and explain those to you that don't fit necessarily real neatly in one section or the other. Article 3 is our special programs area that refers to IDEA and our state special education programs. Article 4 is libraries. And Article 5 is self-sufficiency and lifelong learning, and mainly pertaining to some kindergarten language that we want clarified for the public. So we'll start with Article 1, and Dr. Melcher will go over the provisions there with you. And then as we get to the charter school, we'll jump to Deputy Commissioner Anderson, and she will cover the charter school language.
Thank you. And members, I just want to reiterate what I said this afternoon. We're not going to process the bill this evening, but we will entertain non-controversial amendments or items to clarify, but the full committee, perhaps in the afternoon sometime, or where we have everyone here, or nearly everyone, will have a chance to vote on it before it goes further. Okay, Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Article 1, Section 1 is eliminating a reference to an obsolete report on the condition and value of school property, and it is changing some dates for reports to the department that are made by the school board clerk to conform with other provisions in law. For example, the report on school district revenues and expenditures is due on September 15th under the UFARS law. The report on proposed property taxes is due on September 30th under the levy limitation law. And so this is just making those dates conform to existing dates elsewhere in the law. Section 2 of the bill would move the date for the department to publish the consolidated financial report from January 15th to February 15th. To give the department enough time to get all of the final data in from the school districts and avoid the need to publish the report once in January and then again in February when we have some of the late reporting districts get us the information. Sections 3, 4, and 5 of Article 1 are technical corrections eliminating obsolete language relating to statutory operating debt that goes back to the 1970s. Section 6 is changing the date for the report that the department makes regarding school districts and statutory operating debt from January 1st to February 15th, again, to give the department sufficient time to do the report. The school districts are supposed to report that information to the department by December 30th. And we've had several districts left out of the report in recent years because we haven't had time to get all of that information processed before January 1st. Section 7 deals with the requirements of the audit report for charter schools, and that is clarifying that the if the commissioner receives an audit report indicating a material weakness, that is included in the actual audit report and not in the management letter. So this is conforming the statute to reflect actual audit practice. Section 8 is clarifying that charter schools need to meet the same federal, state, and local health and safety requirements as school districts. Currently, the law doesn't specifically specify federal law, but the department's interpretation is that they have to meet things like ADA and other federal laws that apply.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Education Commissioner. On Section 9, lines 27 and 28, the amendment just adopted actually removed that new language, so it's no longer in front of us. Going to page 6, lines 5, the amendment that was adopted reinstates current language, so the language, if the sponsor is a local school board, is reinstated. On lines 6 and 7, the amendment adopted actually eliminates the new language on that line, so we're conforming back to current law. Line 18, the same thing. The amendment adopted actually deletes the language or not renew the contract. Lines 20 through 22 is new language that when the commissioner considers a change of sponsor, that when the commissioner considers this change, she must expect the new prospective new sponsor that has addressed any outstanding issues raised by the previous sponsor. This is current practice the commissioner uses when looking at requests for change of sponsor, so this is just clarifying existing practice. Line 34 deletes actually the new language from the amendment that was adopted, so that's no longer in consideration.
Section 10 on page 7 of the bill is adding language to clarify the effective date for the change in the QCOMP or Basic Alternative Teacher Compensation Aid formula. During the 2007 legislative session, the state percentage of funding was reduced from 73.1% to 65%. There was an effective date missing. We've been operating off of a letter from the committee chairs clarifying the intent was that that start in fiscal year 2010, and this is codifying that into statute to clarify that that change does take effect in fiscal 2010. Section 11 is updating the language for the building lease levy for desegregation districts to reflect the current desegregation integration aid formula and rule. This was a relatively old law, and the cross references had not been updated for several years. There's no change in policy here. Section 12 and Section 13 are striking a reference made to the consolidated school levy, which was picked up inadvertently from the Senate bill last year. That was part of the Senate bill, but the consolidated levy was not enacted into law. So this is striking a reference to something that did not get enacted into law last year. And that is the end of section or Article 1.
Any questions by the committee on Article 1? Then I'm going to ask if anyone in the audience has a statement of concern on the first article. Committee members, any questions on Article 1? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address us on Article 1? Okay, please proceed to Article 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Section 1 in Article 2 is referring to allowing the Department of Education and the Office of Higher Education to be able to share educational data between their agencies. This request has come from the P16 Partnership. We have been working on extending the student MARS identification number to students that would go to a Minnesota private or public college, and then we would be able to do research on how successful they are in not only enrolling but continuing to succeed in college and doing some educational analysis on remediation, et cetera. So the request is, and the Department of Administration, we worked with them to ask what do we need to do this, and they said that we need to have that permission to share the data. This does meet the FERPA. This is the federal data privacy law. We have talked with them about this. We would come under the FERPA regulations. We also want you to know that there's been some questions about what kind of educational data we're going to collect. We are trying to revise this amendment so that we're really clear that we're going to be collecting student demographic data, enrollment data, student services that are received, such as if they're a gifted and talented student, if they've participated in post-secondary education options, any kind of school-related data that would be school attendance. And we also are specifying that there would not be any health-related or behavioral kinds of data collected. We're not interested in that, or expulsions, suspensions. We are working actually with... we've asked the judiciary members to work with us or to give us suggestions about how to clarify that and make it very clear that we're just interested in educational data. So we will have an amendment for that, but it is not ready at this time. But when we come before you again, we should have that amendment. And Mr. Nauman from your research staff also has been working with us and is aware of an amendment coming.
Okay, and I think Dr. Ephraim, you listed to testify after we get through the article, but I will take notice that the commissioner is working on some language. It might not be to everyone's
agreement, but it is being addressed, and that's noted for the record.
Thank you.
Okay, please proceed to section 2.
My name is Christy Hovanitz-Lasla from the department. Section 2 removes some old language regarding the basic skills test that's been removed and replaced by our grad standards assessment. Section 3 provides some clarification that students with significant cognitive disabilities cannot be exempted from the assessment tests required under NCLB according to the IDEA or the Individuals with Disabilities Act. Section 4 amends to clarify the revision cycle for the state standards and when the assessments will be aligned with those standards.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chaz Anderson, Deputy Education Commissioner. Section 5 actually deletes a restriction that the state may only reimburse each student up to 6 examination fees for the CLEP exam. This was a program passed in 2005. This is in order to get for the state to reimburse for more exams. We find that the restriction on the number of exam fees to be reimbursed is an impediment. So we ask that be removed. Mr. Chair, Section 6 is adding new language to a provision that was adopted in 2007 with the Gifted and Talented Students Program. That's providing, if you see in line 9, page 16, that the district have an identification appeals process. So if a parent believes their child should have been enrolled in the gifted program, they can appeal to the school board, and the school board must have a process for that.
Senator Saltzman.
Right. And on that particular question, Ms. Anderson, is that an issue? Are you hearing from parents that students are not being identified and our school districts responding in any given way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, this actually comes to us from the Gifted Intelligent Organization. They actually have additional language about reporting budgets and other requirements. We did not accept that. This is the one piece that we thought was appropriate, that school districts, if a parent wants to enroll a child in the program, they should probably have an avenue for a parent to at least appeal and make a case for that situation. So I can't tell you specifically. We've had a lot of school districts or parents call us about this, but this does come from the organization and a request from the Gifted and Talented Organization.
Okay, thank you. Up to Section 7. This section adds language that states that if schools or districts are selected to be part of a national or state sample for field testing, that they are to comply with those field testing requests, and there is an exemption provided to the commissioner if there is a hardship where a district or school cannot do that. Section 8 provides that students who...
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would these field tests, what is this for?
Currently, when the department is using or piloting new tests, such as our science test that we are operational for this year, we have to field test those items prior to it actually going operational to ensure that they're accurate and valid items. Also includes participation in the TIMS, which is the math and science assessment, NAEP, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, and other national tests for which we might be required to participate in.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Section 8, lines 19.2, it changes the grade span configurations for the science assessment. Currently, federal law requires we test in elementary grade, middle grade, and a high school grade. This changes the high school grade to configuration to 6 through 8 and 9 through 12, thereby allowing ninth graders to participate in the high school assessment if they've taken the life science or biology course in ninth grade. The section 1930 through 1932 also asks that the assessment results be placed on the student's transcript.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Senator Olsen.
A little slow on the trigger on that, I'm sorry. And what you would just mentioned, is the reason for that that the assessment score be placed on the transcripts to try to give the test a little more meaning for the student so they'll...
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, yes. We are trying to actually make the transcript, take it more seriously for the student, but also encourage any potential employer or educational institution to look at that and say this is a valid result, that it means something.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 10 and Section 11 come from the Board of Teaching, actually. These provisions actually is a case in which what happened in this situation is that a member of the Board of Teaching about year three of a four-year term retired from teaching and then was not allowed to be on the serve for that last year on the Board of Teaching. So what this would say is that those that would retire in the middle of their term or at least had 2 years left of the term could continue to serve on the Board of Teaching, so we wouldn't have to find a replacement for 1 or 2 years. I'm reminded that Section 9 wasn't mentioned. That section is deleting actually obsolete language. It's on page 20, lines 2. It asks us to collect regional. That's something typically we do not do in our accountability system. Lines 3 through 6 is language. Actually, it's data we do not collect or cannot collect. The number of single-parent families, the parents' level of education, parents' income level, or that's this information that we just cannot collect at the department. Members, Section 12 includes changes to the staff development program. This actually comes forward based on a working group that the department participated in with Education Minnesota in conjunction with the Council of Chief State School Officers and the National Education Association. What this does is just clarify a lot of existing practice and best practices that they've looked at. On lines 3, it adds teacher training plans along with staff development. Lines 11 through 13 requires that staff development activities be aligned to the district and school site staff development plans that's based on student achievement data, focused on student learning goals, and used in the classroom setting. Lines 17 through 18 adds additional language about instructional-based observations using objective standards-based assessments to assist in professional growth process for teachers. Lines 19, which is a very much a best practices movement, is moving to regular opportunities for teachers for staff development, including, if you look to lines 23 through 28, providing job-embedded or integrated professional development opportunities during the teacher contract day and identifying instructional strategies that meet student learning goals, plan for instruction, practice new teaching strategies, and review the results of implementation strategies. Lines 30 and 31, just as a technical change, it talks about the alternative teacher professional pay system, and what we've done there is just made some technical language change to include the statute that it's supposed to reference.
Senator Saltzman.
Just a couple questions, if you might, Ms. Anderson. Sure. Could you explain what scientific-based research strategies are? I think there's some concerns about what kind of practices those would include.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, it's a general term that is used in the educational setting that it's also referenced in a lot of federal laws. We've seen that. I know that we've had that discussion mm-hmm. in reading. And it's something that's the National Council of Staff Development uses quite frequently. It's something that's been researched that's shown data can prove that it shows that it's working over a longitudinal period of time. It isn't what we call sort of drive-by research where it looks kind of like it's working, so it's working. So the National Council, like I said, of Staff Development uses that term. They sort of bless research and staff development that meets that test. I could get you the exact definition that's used, but offhand, I cannot repeat it word for word.
It sounds so. It is to me that like is referenced. And just one more thing, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Members, we're on page 21, looking at scientifically based research at 21.14.
Right, 21.14. That you also referenced several times that the plans are based on student achievements and student learning goals. I didn't bring this up during our last group that was here, but Dr. Stuart Yeh at the U of M came out with some research in December about what you know he found to be most effective in closing the achievement gap. And he did talk about the fact of data-driven decision-making and how instruction is really guided by the children and how their achievement. So I like seeing, I think you're kind of referring to that kind of system, the frequent progressive monitoring.
Yep.
In this, so I do like that very much.
Senator Olson, are you for scientifically based research?
Yeah, I am. I think, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Anderson, does it mean more of the kinds of research that involves control groups where there's some validated, it is not survey asking people what they think about things or just general review of a massive amounts of literature on research that may or may not have a strong foundation. Is that kind of where it's trying to go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. Going to Mr. Chair, members of the committee, going to page 22. You see some of the similar language you saw on the previous page with line 6 about aligning to student achievement and student learning goals. Line 11, talking about increasing teacher effectiveness, that should be the goal of staff development outcomes. Line 16, using scientifically based research. Again, you see that term. Lines 24, this area is for the new teachers developing mentoring programs. The research out there is basically the first 5 years is the critical part of a new teacher's career, and so we just added in the first 5 years this should be part of the plan. On line in 22, line 30 on page 22, we changed the date for the staff development report from October 15th to October 1, because that's integrated into one report that the department now takes. We take this along with the school improvement plan, which is due on October 1st, and it just makes sense to have it due all at once, and so they're submitting one report, the district is. Page 23... and that's lines 18. We're really moving away from an in-service staff development model to more of a data-driven, as I said, job-embedded professional development model. And so you'll see some of the changes there, striking in-service, lines 19, that the programs will be for the primary purpose of creating and implementing a district and staff development site. Funds are used to support some of the things that's been stricken is teacher workshops, teacher conferences, cost of substitute teacher staff development purposes. Again, that's moving away from an in-service model to more of a job-embedded professional model, which a lot of districts are moving forward to, and it's part of best practices in staff development.
Mr.
Senator
Saltzman.
I just wondered if Mr. Nauman might suggest that on line 2114 is scientifically based, should that be hyphenated? Would that be consistent with what we have in statute right now?
Madam Chair, Senator Salzman, I apologize. I went ahead. Are you talking about 2114 on page?
Right, 2114, and then again my only on 2216.
Yeah, my only question is that it was research-based before and instructional-based a couple lines down. Is that consistent with what the department is looking for? I've noticed that, Mr. Chair, that they've used scientifically based on a number of occasions, but it's unhyphenated.
It's instructional based is hyphened, but
right.
And so is research based, which was there.
Just for a matter of
hard to know when hyphens are needed.
Mr. Chairman, I understand how consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, but my mind is feeling a little small tonight, so I'm not sure where you want to go with this.
Yes. Commissioner,
Mr. Chair, the scientifically based research and the instructionally based observations is two different items. I would say that we should be hyphenating for consistent. So I would take Senator Saltzman's recommendation to hyphenate scientifically based research on line 16 on page 22.
Okay, we'll consider that a friendly amendment, and Senator Saltzman will have a motion to insert a hyphen at line 21.14 between scientifically and based. Correct, Senator Saltzman?
Yes, please. And on line 22.16 as well.
And right, line 22.16 as well, a hyphen between scientifically and based and in any other subsequent reference if it should appear. Discussion? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We haven't voted yet on discussion on the motion. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Okay, Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Anderson, on the stuff you were just reading in 2321 to like 2323, for instance, on our subcommittee, on Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson's subcommittee, you know, with the RTI stuff where we were learning that, you know, some school districts were sending staff actually out of state to learn this program, would that be affected by some of these changes that you're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, it really depends on what funds they're using to pay for those trainings. This is only the staff development revenue, so this is the 2% set aside. And I'm not sure. It really depends on what funding source they're using to pay for those trainings.
A follow-up?
Senator Olsen.
So then you're saying that would not be appropriate for the staff development, the 2% set aside?
No.
Is that what you're saying? Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I'm not sure what really the focus of that training was. I mean, I guess I can't really comment if it would be allowable or not allowable. That's up to the school district to take the law and apply it and comply. So we don't monitor this. We don't audit this. This is really up to the school district to apply the statute. So they would have to make that judgment call.
Senator Rummel.
Let the commissioner answer.
Commissioner?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think Senator Olsen will just, I think what we did was kind of felt like the, on lines 2320 and reading on, funds may also be used to support plans for challenging instructional activities and experiences. I think that pretty much incorporates if you wanted to send teachers to learn about some instructional practices that are.
Commissioner, could you use the mic a little bit? Just slide it closer to you. Thank you.
I think on lines 2320 and 21, the existing language that says plan that you may use these funds for challenging instructional activities and experiences would cover any kinds of examples that Senator Olsen gave as far as sending staff to learn about something that has to do with RTI or whatever it is, that I think that would cover it. It just seems like this is kind of redundant language, and the two expressions there would cover anything that and would be up to the discretion of the school board and the school teachers to decide how to use that money.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, I mean, what happens is that the teachers and the district should come together and put together a plan, a staff development plan. And the language included that the money must be used for these purposes. So we're striking that language. Doesn't mean they can't use it for those purposes if they find it meets the needs of the plan and it meets the what the law says. And that's just for this revenue. That doesn't include any other revenues that they may be using for staff development or teacher training activities. So, again, this is a parameter. The locals are going to put their plan together, and it's going to look different from district to district.
Thanks. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give me just a little background on where you're going with these changes? I mean, like I see a lot of interwoven, you know, QComp kinds of activities, which are good in the sense that if you look at, see if I can find a couple here. provided job embedded or integrated professional development opportunities during the teacher's contract day.
Sorry, Stump, which page are you?
I'm on page 21.
Okay.
What I'm getting at is basically, if you're a district that has Q comp money, the $260, it sure helps to have that $260 to hire a substitute or to provide some resources to carry a number of these activities out. But what about those districts that don't have that? And some of the complaints I hear on the staff development is that it's not enough money to hardly send a few teachers off to a conference someplace.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I think what we are seeing across the country is the reexamination of how we are preparing our teachers not only to come into the profession, you know, once they've graduated and received their license, looking at mentoring opportunities, but also looking and having the discussion about how we can continually professionally develop our experienced teachers. And clearly, what is happening, and this is happening through the teachers' unions, it's happening in national school board discussions, it's happening at the chief state school officers level too, is that we really need to think about how we're going to bring really highly qualified teachers into the profession and then supporting them in an ongoing way. And these principles are principles that are being discussed and are being agreed to nationally. These are not, you know, yes, they certainly reflect a lot of the policy of QCOMP, but they are also very fundamental good practices that I know since being in the legislature and before that on the school board that we talked about, that we wanted our teachers to have the kind of job-embedded professional development where, and now that we've got good data that we're collecting, we can really start to examine that data and look at instructional practices. So we feel like this is, a positive step. We have worked with, as Deputy Commissioner Anderson said, with Education Minnesota, and we've actually attended national meetings where our national teachers union representatives, school boards, chief state school officers were all at the table talking about how we wanted to, continue and encourage this kind of professional development for the future. There is the 2% set aside for staff development. That's about $100 a student. Certainly, districts have access to the QCOMP dollars if they want to participate and put an application in and do that also. But we hope that this will be some fundamental changes that we think are really important and actually have been worked on, you know, in a very collaborative way with our educational organizations.
Mr. Chairman, don't get me wrong. I think a lot of these are good practices. I was just saying or trying to get the point across that if you were District A and had $260 more to participate and hire substitute teachers and have in-class analysis and feedback, that's a whole lot different than District B, who doesn't have the $260 or is a very small district. And when they add up the $100 per pupil, it comes to maybe $3,000. And they can't do a whole lot. I think the point I was making is that there's a great disparity between the resources that one district has and the resources another district has, and the expectations are going to be very similar.
Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I can only say that...
Bring that back.
I'm sorry. I'm still struggling with my laryngitis. As I said, I think good practices that should be implemented. There is professional development monies that can be used for this. You can also apply and participate. We still have resources available under QComp. We have many small districts that participate in QComp and would love to have more. We have very small charter schools that participate, probably smaller than some of the small districts we have in Minnesota, that are really using the money successfully. So we are seeing this as a really positive step, that there are, you know, set-aside resources that that they can set aside for this this activity.
Okay, please proceed. Senator Doris Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, sorry to interrupt you, but I was just in healthcare downstairs, so I didn't want to miss this opportunity. In the language that we have here, I noticed that English language learners are not mentioned, and I was wondering if I could use this opportunity.
Could you cite the page?
Page 22. But throughout this, I thought that this presents kind of an opportunity to look at the different populations you have in named in 1, 2, and 3 from 22-16 all the way to 22-22. And in 2, we have including the different populations, diverse student population, including at-risk children, children with disabilities. And I think that the English language learners are missing in these categories. So I was hoping I could have the opportunity to incorporate that language into that particular group.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I think probably the intent was that some of that with the at-risk populations are ethnically and culturally diverse would cover that, but we would certainly be open to specifying English language learners in either one of those clauses. We're not opposed to that at all, to clarify that we also are certainly wanting to look at professional development that would be supporting ELL learners. So,
thank you.
We'll have an amendment prepared.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Senator Torres-Ray, lines 20 through 22 don't encompass your concern?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it kind of does, but it's kind of an indirect way, and I think when we talk about language, this is kind of a good opportunity to provide that specific language because the training on language acquisition is very particular. It's not just about understanding the culture of a child. It's really understanding how to work with children that speak different languages and how they could acquire a different language in this case. For children that don't speak English, you know, how can they learn that skill? And I understand that these are specific practices that go beyond kind of the cultural aspect, you know, understanding how to interact with the child. There's a specific training that is now available to teachers. So I think it's a good opportunity for us to engage teachers in understanding how that works. And this is also for children that have disabilities in terms of language acquisition too. It's both. It's not just cultural. Sometimes it goes beyond, you know, kind of the culture of the child is kind of the cognitive skill that teachers really need to understand.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that if you want to put the ELL language in there, that you would want to insert it in clause 2 and add at-risk ELL inserted after at-risk children, then ELL, comma, children with disabilities. I think that's where it more appropriately fits. I think that Senator Torres-Ray is right. The next clause is talking about cultural diversity ideas, and it's really we're talking about what are the kind of best practices in instructing ELL learners.
Okay, Senator Torres-Ray makes that motion. It would be lines 22-17. Should we spell out
after at-risk children?
Right. After at-risk.
18.
And 18?
Mr. Chairman?
Children on line 18.
Right. But should we
English language
spell it out before using abbreviation? And And then there's a subsequent reference. Commissioner, did you have a second spot? So that'll do it?
That will do it. Thank you.
Okay, and Senator Torres raised motion. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving on to Section 14 on pages 24 and 25. This is part of the amendment that was adopted, so the changes start on page 25, lines 8 and 10 after the word district. The amendment added or charter school to that. If you go to line 13, the same change, added charter school after the word district. On lines 13, 25, what we intend to say there, actually, be on line 17, page 25, it's 1.13 in the amendment. It would say a full-time online provider is, so it would say a full-time online provider is subject to the reporting requirements, and then the previous language would be deleted. What this is doing is correcting a loophole in our current online learning statute where we have entities that become no longer take part-time students. They take full-time students instead, so they're not subject to the reporting requirements in online learning. As you may know, last session, Senator Saxhog had a bill to require that the online providers demonstrate that their curriculum is aligned to standards. And so what we've had happened is that instead of taking part-time and full-time students, the providers will take full-time students as a charter school, and then they're no longer subject to the requirements of demonstrating alignment to standards. So what we're attempting to do here is to close that loophole, and if you are a district or charter school that only offers full-time online learning, no other seat time classes, that you are subject to the requirements of online learning, which is required to that your curriculum demonstrate that your curriculum is aligned to standards.
Senator Saltzman.
I have a question, and this may take us in a whole different direction. If it does, I will drop the question. But if you have a child and you are homeschooling the child and you want them to take an online course at an online school, I understand you have to be either full-time or you can't be a part-time student at that school. Is that...
Because Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, unfortunately, this was an issue when we first enacted the law in 2003, and I'm trying to remember.
Well,
and the part was that they didn't want it to become just a homeschool initiative.
Okay.
And I think that you can be enrolled as part-time in an online program, but you also need to be enrolled in a district or charter school as well. So, for instance, you could be enrolled in the Hopkins School District and take one or two courses from the Houston Virtual Academy. And that's very typical. I'm going to have Dr. Melcher, because he can explain the funding and how it works.
Specifically, if you are if you homeschool your child and you want them and the student is enrolled at Houston full-time and then the parent says, but I don't like their English program, I'd like to not take that, they cannot take any of the classes through Houston unless they're completely full-time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saltzman, the funding for students who are meeting compulsory attendance by enrolling in a private school, which would include a home school, the funding comes through the shared time statute. And under the shared time statute, a student can only receive funding if they're taking the courses at the public school. And so a homeschooler would not be allowed to take most of their courses at home and then enroll in an online program because the statute would require them to be at the public school, and presumably they're accessing that from home and not by going into the public school to access the program.
Okay. Thank you. And this does not address that. I just wanted to clarify.
Okay. Good. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 15 actually reenacts the Charter School Advisory Council. This council sunsetted last June 30th of 2007. So what we're proposing is to reenact and revive the Charter School Advisory Council.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Going back to 2510 and 2513, Should those two references to district also include charter school or not?
It does. That's the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, that was incorporated in the amendment, the First Amendment you adopted.
10 is in there? Oh, yeah.
Thanks. 1.10 on the amendment. Okay. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, page 26, section 16.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a question with respect to the advisory council and the expiration date. Could you tell me, this advisory council brings, it says here, shall bring to the attention of the commissioner any matters related to charter schools. What is the budget associated with this particular council? Does the department have a budget associated with the responsibilities?
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, there is no budget for this. This is an advisory council that is made up of volunteers. We try to pay for probably some. We don't. Okay, we don't anymore. We used to at least pay for maybe some lunch or something if they came and spent the day. But this is purely a voluntary organization or council that we use to just help us with some of our charter school issues.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, page 26, lines 32 and 33, the amendment that was adopted deleted the new language and application, so that's no longer in front of us. On page 27, if you look on the amendment on lines 18 and 19, after the new language in the form and manner prescribed by the commissioner, inserted new language that states the sponsor must submit an affidavit to the commissioner for each charter school proposes to authorize. This is just clarifying basically existing practice. What happens is that if an entity wants to become a sponsor, they submit an affidavit to the commissioner that they've met the requirements of being a sponsor. Only entities that can be a sponsor is a local school board, a higher education institution registered with the Office of Higher Education, or a nonprofit that meets the standard of having a $2 million fund balance, they're registered with the Attorney General's Office, and they're registered with the Council of Nonprofits. Once that happens, then that does not mean that they can just start any charter school they want. They have to come back to the department with a specific application for each charter school that they want to authorize. And this clarifies that practice. We believe that we need this clarification of practice because there's some out there that believe that sponsors should have the right to start any charter schools once the commissioner deems that they have met the letter of the law with the submission of the affidavit. So what this does is just basically put into practice what we have done. I believe the department has done for the past, since this law became enacted in 1993, and that is every time that a sponsor wants to authorize a new charter school, they need to submit an application to the department for approval.
Sir Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, do the charter schools, and I think it was earlier on in some of the language, that they have to comply with chapter 363A. And it was on page 4 and 5. It goes through a list, Mr. Chairman and members, it goes through a list of what charter schools have to comply with. And one of the sections is 363A, which is, I believe, the chapter. Council can probably tell me quicker than I can looking it up. But
it's not listed here.
My question is. 363. My question is that There have been some. This is the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Some discussion that some charter schools are not open. They're almost like my understanding of charter schools is that they have to be open to the general public and not like a cultural charter school for a particular group. How do they comply with the Chapter 363A when that occurs?
Where's
363A? 363A is G on top of page 5. They have to comply with 363A and Section 121A.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, charters, this is an issue that came up this summer, and we provided lengthy correspondence to charter schools and technical assistance on this issue. Charter schools are public schools. They're open to all. They cannot restrict enrollment based on abilities. You can go on the whole list, a disability or anything like that, race, gender, and along the list. And they have to have an open policy, and really basically the only information they can ask up front is the student's name, age, what grade they're going to enroll in, and contact information. They can't even ask, you know, do you have an IEP? Do you have any test results? Do you want, please write an essay? We saw one of them like that. They cannot even ask that information. They can only ask basic information, contact information, name a student, what grade they're going to enroll in. If a charter school, though, is full, meaning they only have space for 300 students, but they have 400 students that want to enroll, the law prescribes in 124D.110 that they have to have a lottery system. And there are some preferences given to the lottery system, for example, if they have a sibling in the school. But it's prescribed in law and what they're supposed to do in a situation when they have more students that want to enroll in the school than they have space available. But they are public schools. They cannot screen out students based on the list in the Human Rights Act, which is 363.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Anderson, I think what you're saying is that nominally, this is how it's supposed to be. And practically, it's different. And whether they're working the system, those individual charter schools, how does the department know? I mean, it's kind of obvious in some charter schools that they're not abiding by the statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, one of the issues that when it came up this summer, we requested that each charter school submit to the department their application for enrollment. And if the application for enrollment included screening information, they were required to remove that information as part of their approved application. And we did go through that this summer and fall and did find a number of applicants who, not for nefarious reasons, they just wanted more information up front when the student enrolled into the school. But they can only ask basic information of the student that wants to enroll in the school, and we have screened applications for those purposes. If there's specific complaints, we do investigate those complaints and order changes, and we did have a situation in one charter school this past summer where that happened, and they were ordered to make corrective action and did so. So we do follow up. We do a broad review of the application, the enrolling application annually, and then we also investigate complaints that come to the department.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, to that point, can an entity get around that by developing a program that is specifically targeted to one category that essentially no one else would apply? So they wouldn't ask the questions on the application, but the very structure and role of the school is one that would be limiting.
Recruitment.
Members of the committee, Senator Olson, Senator Weger. I'm Karen Klensing, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Education. And we in the application process for a charter school, and a charter school applies with the department, they are required in the application to do a pretty extensive description of what their recruitment plan is for recruiting amongst a wide range geographically as well as population-wise. And that is scrutinized pretty heavily by an external advisory board, review board, that reviews those. So it's people who are familiar with charter schools and running charter schools and that recruitment plan. And then if complaints come in that recruitment plan's not being put into place, certainly we investigate those as well. So that's also another way that we can monitor that recruiting.
But Mr. Chairman, that still doesn't speak to the actual structure and function and the way in which a school could be targeted to one particular group of people, and therefore none of those things would really matter. It would be more in the approval of the school in itself rather than in how they're appealing to attract students.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I think I am following what Senator Olson's talking about. Like, say a school sets up to be a math and science curriculum, you know, on rocket ships or something. So obviously it seems like, oh, probably going to have a lot of boys signing up for that. Is that kind of where you're going, that they can kind of set their, almost describe their curriculum and...
I think that the traditional academic subjects are not going to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
This discussion we're having is one that, I want to be really honest with it, we struggle with, too. Charter schools also are, as the way they were designed, were to be innovative, and were supposed to provide some research and development types of opportunities that then could also be replicated for the public school system, too. So as we've seen charter schools develop, we have seen, for example, we've had requests for all girls' schools, all boys' schools. We see requests for schools that want to focus on high-level autistic children. But, under our charter school law, they must admit any student that wants to come to that school. They must, So if a typical student wanted to come, they have to educate them, too. But their focus is on, serving those students also. So you get into this dilemma of, innovative programs that parents and teachers are creating and wanting to try to serve children in ways that maybe they are not being served in the public school system, or they want to try to, to do some of the research and development types of things. So you get into this this tension, frankly, of what our authority is, making sure that they are fulfilling the law, and trying to meet that, and then making sure that they aren't doing anything that would be against, what we would want all of our public schools to be doing.
Just a follow-up, too. This is not a unique debate either. I think this is a debate that goes on within our traditional public school system, too, as they try to create culturally aware curriculums and programs, as well as magnet school programs that try to do the same thing. They try to attract students who would be interested in those topics. And so I think that this debate is something that's not just unique to charter schools and the innovation that they're trying to further.
Senator Saltzman.
So on that same point, Mr. Chair, is there anything in statute where a charter school is out of compliance in like relationship to its community? I know that we have the integration districts to try to make sure that we have a greater diversity within our schools. But I think to Senator Stump's point, to go back to, are there charter schools that tend to be, that aren't as diverse as its community because it attracts a specific population? And I guess I just wonder, is there anything here that as we're trying to work with our traditional public schools to
you know, move children around. I know I get, you know, letters not from my district but some other districts where, you know, school district boundaries are being changed or children are being moved so that there is greater balance. Are charter schools ever required to have balance as well? Or then to, you know, develop a recruitment plan to create balance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, as Assistant Commissioner Klinzing said, we look at the recruiting very importantly, and we don't want to intentionally create segregated schools. As a follow-up to the DSEG rule, charter schools are not subject to the desegregation rule. And a little bit later in this bill, we clarify that charter schools, the statute says charter schools are subject to the requirements in 124D10, and that's it. We clarify it over the years. Charter schools have been added to a number of statutes, not in 124.10, so we clarify they're subject to all rules that are applicable to them, but they are not subject to the desegregation rule.
Sarah Romo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To continue this conversation, it was said that charter schools have been promoted in our state to capture innovation, and I'm just wondering, in the criteria for becoming a charter school, do they have to state the innovation that they are going to address, and is there a way to capture what they have learned from that innovation?
It's an excellent question, and it is one that we try to keep paramount in the division of choice and school innovation. There is a requirement in the application that they state what that innovation is, and there have been applications where reviewers have reviewed them and said they don't see the innovation, and therefore that application has received low points for that section. And then secondly, there are dissemination grants that are awarded. In fact, we just had an RFP out on the department website for requests for proposals from charter schools. These grants only go to those schools that are willing to disseminate their innovative practices to other schools. And those are federally funded grants that have been ongoing for a couple of years.
Sarah Romo.
But by their very nature, shouldn't all of them without grants be disseminating what they're learning? It seems to me that they've been given some special category or status that it would seem to me that we should be capturing that by virtue of the fact that they are charter schools.
Thank you. We are actually in the process of developing some infrastructure and automatic policies by which those charters will just kind of, as they mature enough to be doing that disseminating, that they will automatically do that. Now, just because a charter starts does not mean it's automatically going to be successful and therefore be an innovative practice that others might be interested in replicating. So there has to be a process by which there's a maturing factor for the charter schools and recognition by those around them that they would like to adopt those kinds of innovative practices.
Okay, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, on the amendment on lines 16 and 17, this is new language inserted on page 26, line 33. We're adding additional language: when a sponsor submits an affidavit to become an authorized sponsor, that they must demonstrate the sponsor's abilities, capabilities, and expertise in fulfilling the responsibilities of a sponsor. That's very important because we want to have solid and experienced sponsors who can oversee the charter schools they have contracts with. Going to page 27, this is again from the amendment. On the amendment, you'll see this as 1.21 on the amendment where it says after 5, insert non-related. This relates to the board of directors for the charter school, that it must be composed of at least 5 non-related members. This clarifies just to make sure that we have a functional board. If you go on the amendment to 122 on the amendment, which is actually page 27, line 14, instead of having the word may, which is permissive, that all parents of children enrolled at the school are eligible to participate in the election. This is something that's, again, clarifying existing practice that parents have a vote and who serves on the board of directors. If on page 27, after line 21, we're inserting language
On the amendment, you'll see that as one point, starting at 1.24, this states the granting or renewal of a charter school by a sponsor must not be contingent on the charter school being required to contract, lease, or purchase services from the sponsor. The sponsor is prohibited from entering into a contract to provide management and financial services for a school that is authorized to sponsor. Sponsors are supposed to oversee the charter school, and if the sponsor is making a contract contingent on contracting with them for management services, or that is happening, it's hard to oversee yourself, so to speak. And so this provides independence for the sponsor.
Senator Olson, followed by Saltzman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on 127, line 127 of the amendment, I think you need to add the word after that. You need to insert it.
It is, okay.
That the sponsor, that it is authorized to sponsor.
Yes. Yeah, I presume you agree. Yes. Senator Olson makes that motion at line 1.27 on the A4 between that and is insert yet. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Carried. Senator Saltzman.
Mr. Chair, on the amendment that is line 1.24 to 1.27, we've had some discussions about charter school lease aid and how in communities where there is declining enrollment and there's empty school buildings, that, if a school district was to be a sponsor, maybe that would be a good thing to encourage them to use existing school buildings. So I would be concerned if perhaps that may allow a school district to reach out to looking to charter schools as an incentive to using its existing buildings. Would this particular amendment, Mr. Nauman, not allow a school district to require a charter school using its facilities? And if so, I'd like to maybe propose some language that school districts be exempt from this. Would you like to think about that?
Just to add to this discussion, this language comes from the Association of Charter Schools. I would agree that we probably should exempt school boards from this because some of them are looking at the charter schools, the existing sponsor, moving them into empty facilities that they may have and then leasing that. Mm-hmm. I guess we would be supportive of exempting school districts from that.
So perhaps, Mr. Nauman, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Nauman could think about that as a friendly amendment.
Senator Olson.
The granting or renewal, the sponsor can't make it contingent on their being required to contract, lease, or purchase services from the sponsor. So you think if they really didn't want that facility, they could find a different sponsor, I suppose, in the school district. But there's nothing we can come up with that somebody can't figure out a way around. You know that.
I think, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, Saltzman's issues with the second sentence, not the first one. The first one is just saying give you a contract if you lease my buildings from me.
I would like it to say that.
You like the first sentence, but the second sentence says you're prohibited from entering into any contract, and you're concerned that at that point a school district couldn't offer empty facilities to charter schools. Is that
something Mr. Chairman, Ms. Anderson? That just says that the second sentence does not allow them to get into the management and financial services for the school. Now, if that's different than the use of facilities that Senator Saltzman is talking about.
Right. Senator Olson is late.
At the very least, should it maybe not be prohibitive? I'm not sure how you modify that first sentence, unless, as you say, you exempt a public school.
Okay. Maybe the school district would want to allow them to use their gym or something.
They what?
Their gymnasium. They couldn't do it.
They couldn't, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Members, staff's going to process the input and we'll revisit it when we
take it up on another day.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
I agree with you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, lines on the amendment, if you go to it, lines 28 and 29 of the amendment, just renumber everything in order. Lines 30 to 33 on the amendment, form to page 28, line 24, and that is if there's a violation of conflict of interest laws, it gives the commissioner additional authority that if a violation of this requirement renders a contract voidable at the option of the commissioner, the charter school aid may be reduced by the commissioner under section 127A.42 if the charter school fails to correct violations under the subdivision in a timely manner. 127A.42 is a statute used for school district violations that gives the commissioner authority to reduce or withhold school aid. So this is aligning that statute for charter schools under the conflict of interest provision. Mr. Chair, going to, if you go to page 28, lines 33, 34, and then on to page 29, lines 1 and 2, this is some language I talked about previously. There's some confusion within the charter school community about some believe that if it's in 124D.10, these are the only laws they need to conform with. And over the years, charter schools have been subject to laws in other statutes, but that have not been referenced back to 124D.10. So what we're clarifying there is that they are exempt from all statutes and rules except provided in this section or provided in another section of law.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Anderson, how do we know that we're picking up what we're supposed to be picking up? I mean, this is kind of this sentence is kind of a broad brush. A charter school is exempt from all statutes and rules applicable to a school, board, or district unless provided by this section. I guess what I'm wondering is, what assurances can you give me that we've picked up what we're supposed to pick up?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, the current law actually says, except as provided in this section, a charter school is exempt from all statutes and rules applicable to a school, a board, or a district, although it may elect to comply with one or more provisions of statutes or rules. And so there's some that believe that even if we insert requirements for charter schools and other statutes and not put it into 124D, they do not have to comply with that statute. So I think that the language we are proposing here would tighten it and say that a charter school is exempt from all statutes and rules applicable to a school, board, or district unless provided in this section or provided in another section of statutes and rules. So I think we're picking up and clarifying that just because a requirement wasn't put in 124D.110 and perhaps was put into another statute, that the charter school still has to comply with all statutes and rules to which have been written into statute and rules, which they have been written into statute or rule. Mr. Chair, going to Section 19, this is expanding the definition of definitions within the conflict of interest law to related party lease costs. This goes on page 29 from lines 12 to lines 23. This mirrors what we are required to do under the federal law. The federal law is much more strict than the state law, and so we've had to apply two different levels of conflict of interest statutes to the state laws and state funding versus federal laws and federal funding. And so what we're doing here is just applying the federal standard to the related party lease costs. Mr. Chair, going to the amendment, just to that specific language that needs to be added to the bill, if you go to page 2 of the amendment, lines 15 through 17, this is additional language added to the bill that allows, right now, a sponsor can only offer a contract up to 3 years. It can be 3 years or less. What we're adding here is that for the initial contract, it's 3 years. And after the initial contract, they can have up to a 5-year contract based on academic, financial, and operation performance of the schools. So it allows additional flexibility to have a longer contract if the sponsor believes the school has met academic, financial, and operation performance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Ms. Anderson, is there some stuff in there about, you know, like if a a PTA or something is able to purchase a building and lease it to the charter school. I mean, I know we've had some discussions about there's been some pretty creative financing for some of these charter school buildings. And it seems like some of these are really kind of stretching the...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, this is a discussion we've had a lot ever since we created the charter school law back in 1992 and how we would fund the physical spaces for students that go to charter schools. So we created the lease aid law, and that's a per pupil amount. Started at $1,500, now it's at $1,200. We've talked in the past about trying to create some kind of a loan program or way that charter schools, after being in existence for a while, could actually purchase a building instead of continually lease them. We have just not come up with a way of doing that. It would take probably some substantial amount of a pool of money to allow, you know, them to, you know, create some kind of a loan program, if you will, to pay it back over time. The few charter schools, I think there's about 20 out of about 100, and I don't know, what is the current, 180 charter schools now, or 150 charter schools that have that kind of an agreement. One of the things, though, you have to have somebody willing to put up quite a bit of money or build a building or purchase a building or have a building that's at their, you know, that maybe they already own, to be willing to lease it. So you have to upfront some pretty significant money to even lease that back. So we're not seeing that this is a, you know, like a huge wave of people doing this. But we have talked about how could we, after a charter school's in existence for a long time, you know, maybe purchase a building instead. And we just haven't, you know, come up with, you know, any kind of a solution at this point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, continuing with the changes in the amendment, if you go on the amendment on page 2, this sort of gets to our discussion about the Human Rights Act. Lines 18 through 22, the current language is, if a board of directors provides special instruction and services, and we're changing that to how the board of directors or operators of the charter schools will provide special instruction. So it's very clear that if they have a special education student that enrolls, that they need to provide the service. It's not if, it's how they do it. Lines on the amendment, line 34, clarifies that when there's a cause, when there's a termination of the contract for cause, that it be done in writing by registered mail, so there's no disagreement about what date actually triggered the termination, because a number of activities needs to happen after the termination happens, so that's very clear. Going on page 3, we're deleting current law language on 7, that the sponsor must take final action to renew or not renew a contract on the last day of classes in the school year. What we're proposing to do is change that to no later than 15 days before the termination date of the end of the contract. We've had some disagreements on what's really the last day of classes, and so a contract specifies an end date. We're going to pick 15 days prior to the end of that contract. They have to have a final action. Lines 19 through 28 of the amendment on page 3 really clarifies voluntary termination, which is not very clear in law. And I think when the law was first drafted, it really wasn't a situation that was contemplated, and that is if a sponsor and charter school mutually agree to terminate the contract. They both agree they want to terminate the contract, and most times it's one side wants to terminate the contract, and usually it's the sponsor wants to terminate, and there's very set procedures for that. But what this does is set procedures, which we've had questions about, is that if they both mutually agree to voluntarily terminate the contract, they must do so jointly and submit in writing to the commissioner its intent to terminate the contract. And then we strike language that the party intending to terminate the contract must notify the other party. Well, if they're both mutually agreeing to terminate, they must do so jointly in writing. It doesn't really make sense. It doesn't work very well. Lines 33 through, if you go to page 4, lines 1, that is... provides the commissioner with authority after providing reasonable notice to the board of directors of a charter school and the existing sponsor
And after providing opportunity for public hearing, that the commissioner may terminate the sponsor relationship between the charter and the sponsor if they met one of four criteria, which is also the same criteria or very similar criteria that a sponsor has when terminating a contract with the charter school. That is, number one, sustained failure to meet the requirements for pupil performance contained in the contract, two, financial mismanagement, three, repeated violations of the law, or four, other good cause shown. Mr. Chair, that actually then concludes the charter school provisions of the bill. What I think we could do is just go into Section 20 and then pick up the rest of the amendment for Article 2 as at the end. So with that, Kathy Wagner here is to talk about Section 20.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Wagner. I'm the Information Technology Director. We've been working with a technology task force all fall to come up with recommendations for policy language that would allow us to collect uniform information from all districts in the state regarding their technology infrastructures. The proposed language here has six areas that we would focus on with collecting information from districts: instructional technology, technology tools, network and data systems administration, data practices, data management, and facilities infrastructure. We would be fleshing out additional standards below these six areas that we would publish annually and review with the technology committee made up of technology coordinators from districts. The information we would collect would be collected online, and we would be able to pull information from every district in the state so we would understand where gaps would exist. We also will be beginning this summer to develop a common data definitions for required elements, including a common course catalog, which will allow us to do quite a bit more intense analysis of student achievement and both leading and lagging indicators. We want to identify common transcript definitions and common district technology infrastructure standards.
Senator Saltzman.
You know, I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering, is this just another report to districts, or what is the intent of this? Do we have a plan now as to did this technology group come up with some plan of what should be in districts now so that whatever a district submits is measured? Like, because when you say that there's a gap or it's inadequate, what are our expectations for districts right now? And I'm not quite sure what a common course catalog means. Because in this area, we are so deficient, and I mean, we're so across the board. And I'm just wondering, when we've asked districts, you know, to turn in this information, what will we do with it? How will it improve student achievement? So I wonder if you could address that just briefly.
Senator Saltzman, let me address the reporting aspect of this first. Districts currently are required to do technology planning, and it's in the form of strategic planning. They do a strategic plan about every 3 years. What we'd like to do is transition them from a paper-based strategic plan on technology to an online plan, which would give us better access to their information. We don't really have any good information to know. For example, how many districts have good connectivity to provide and support online assessment requirements. We know what they tell us if they answer, I think, what is maybe a little bit disconnected survey. So this is our attempt to, in a much more coordinated fashion, in an ongoing fashion, collect and maintain this information. We would like districts to update annually anything that's significantly changed in their technology infrastructure. So this is, we're going to transition from what we're currently requiring districts to give us for federal reporting reasons into a state plan that I think will be more useful for us. So that's the first piece. The second piece, a common course catalog, is really just a numbering scheme to help us understand what kinds of courses students take to better understand course-taking patterns and how they affect achievement for students in the K-12 system as well as post-secondary. We don't really know right now how many kids actually take Algebra 2 in the state, for example. We don't really know how many kids take College in the Schools English, for example. So this is an exercise in probably adapting something like Iowa has a Common Course Catalog project underway. The National Center for Education Statistics has a numbering scheme for Common Course Catalog. So we would take an existing system, an existing catalog, and probably adapt it to Minnesota's courses. And it's I've also heard it referred to as the Minnesota Transition Curriculum that MinSCU has done over the last couple of years. So it gives everyone a common way to describe courses that are taught.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further questions on the technology?
Okay, please proceed. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, section 21 on page 30, lines 13 through 15, is just a reference to reviving the Charter School Advisory Committee that we discussed earlier. Section 22 is the revisor's instructions. I will just to go back to the amendment, page 4, lines 13 and 14. This is something that wasn't picked up in the final bill in 2007. It's common language for grant programs that it has carry forward language from year one to year two, that any balance in the first year that doesn't cancel is available second year to be spent. And that's for the advanced placement, pre-advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and concurrent enrollment programs. Mr. Chair, going to Article 3, which is special programs.
Members, any other questions on Article 2? Dr. Ephraim, I know the point. We know your point on the sharing of information, and you've shared that a couple of times, and I noted it for the record. And
I just want to say two sentences.
Two sentences, fine. Please join us at the mic, and then we will be, and then Ed Minnesota will have a brief statement. Remember, we're not going to take action, but we would like to, frame some of the issues that we're going to be following up on. So, yes, Dr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Karen Ephraim, EdWatch. I just want to say that we appreciate the department's careful work on this, but just want to remind the committee that Chapter 13.32 talks about educational data as individual data, and it does include health, mental health, family data, and other things, so that however this is clarified, it needs to clearly state that it is aggregate, that it is not individually identifiable, and that it doesn't include those things that are not related to academic performance, such as medical and mental health data.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. And from Ed Minnesota, we have a statement.
Mr. Chair, Renee Lara, Education Minnesota. From hearing the testimony, our concern is related to the staff development section. In talking with the department, it turns out that I may be in the unenviable position of having to express a concern over a section we might have helped formulate. I tried to contact our experts who may have been involved in with a council of chief state school officers or any of the groups nationally that might have consented to some of these principles and how they came to be reflected in the language before you is still not clear to me. Our legal department, though, however, has expressed and flagged a provision, the one on section 21 or line 21.16, relating to the requirements of new requirements for staff development. It says that activities must provide opportunities to receive instructional-based observations. That language is, to us, language that is borrowed from or similar to the QCOMP language, according to our legal department. And, in fact, the concern is pretty much the one that Senator Stump has expressed, that this would be a requirement that is not followed by funding, similar to what the QCOMP programs are. The other item is in the previous page, page 20, relating to the Board of Teaching, the change that would allow someone who is appointed, who is an active teacher at the time of appointment, but who retires, and this language would allow that person to remain on the board after they retire. We feel that the members of the Board of Teaching ought to be active teachers throughout. This language would allow someone to spend most of their or a majority of their time in retirement, having been appointed to the board as an active teacher. Those are the two items that we wish to flag for right now, and I know that the work is in progress, and there's a few other concerns that are fairly relatively minor, but I know that we need to leave the room before Senator Stump's committee comes in, and at I don't wish to be
it's
part of the
program. Another 11 and a half hours. So.
Is there anyone else that would like to address the committee on Article 2? Okay. Follow-up is noted, and we'll obviously revisit this before committee deadline, but ask that various parties continue to discuss amongst yourselves and with us as we get closer. Senator Olson.
Just in case I don't survive until we get to the end, if we're going to be taking this up by this committee again, would you have it engrossed?
Yes, that would be our intent, Mr. Nauman.
You have an engrossed copy? Because it gets a little difficult because there's some major sections here that could be included in that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson will take care of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next article.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Article 3, I'd like to first note on the amendment on page 4 that was adopted. Page 31, the entire Section 2 was deleted, so we're only going to talk about Section 1. Section 2 is deleted because we feel that we need more input from stakeholders, and I guess the language is not ready for prime time. So with that, we're just only Section 1 remains, and Dr. Lasala will talk about that.
Thank you. Section 1, Subdivision 1, changes the notification of parents once a student is enrolled in an English language learners program in the district from 10 days to 30 days to be more compliant and in line with the No Child Left Behind Act, specifically Title III.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in section Article 4 in the libraries, there's just a change in what the Minnesota Library will be called. It will now be called the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library. And then in same thing in Section 2. And then in Section 3, there was a request to allow them to have meetings with a quorum where they would be off-site, where they would be able to do it either via telephone conference call or via now my mind's gone blank, but you know what I mean, with the TV interactive ITV, thank you. That would give them permission to be able to conduct that. You have many people that, because of their disability, may not be able to come physically to a place.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Nauman?
I'm sorry to take us backwards. Was it the commissioner's intent to delete Article 3, Section 3? The amendment only took out Article 3, Section 2. And I think we skipped over that section. I just want to clarify the intent.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, thank you for that. It's getting late here. Section 3 is not intended to be deleted. This is language that's been requested by the Department of Human Services. We are striking language that minus up to 5% retained by the Commissioner of Human Services for administrative costs not to exceed $350,000. So the language would provide the commissioner the opportunity to withhold 5% of each payment to a school district for these specific services for medical assistance.
Okay. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. If you return to the amendment on page 4, beginning on line 20, there is a provision dealing with the Minnesota State Academies that would include behavioral management aides in the special education funding formula. The academies currently provide behavioral management aids. These are aids that work with the students at the academy after the regular instructional day. The academies have been providing these aids to children with disabilities that require that service throughout the course of the day, and they've been billing the school districts for that cost, and this would include that cost in the special education funding formula, consistent with what we currently do with one-on-one instructional aids. And there's some lack of clarity in terms of when does the school day end and to what extent are these aids providing instructional support to the students, you know, in their after-school hours as well as during school. And what this would do would be to include that the cost of the behavioral management aids, the one-on-one behavioral management aids, in the special education funding formula beginning in fiscal year 2008. And on the next page of the amendment, on line 5.8 and 5.9, it would clarify that the academies may retain receipts received through mutual agreements with school districts for one-on-one behavioral management aids for fiscal year 2007. So what the academies did for 2007 was to bill the school districts for this. All of the school districts except for one school district paid the bills that the academies sent them. The other school district was challenging whether the academies legally had the right to bill for these behavioral management aids. So it was kind of in a kind of a limbo situation. And what this is intended to do is to clarify that in the future, the funding for these would be primarily from the special education funding formula. Also in Section 2 is another amendment relating to the academies, and this is clarifying that the academies must seek reimbursement for third-party reimbursement for services provided under the public health plans. The academies are currently doing this. The finance department has questioned, and school districts are required to do this as well. The finance department has questioned whether there is clear legal authority for the academies to do this in the event that it was ever challenged, and this would maintain the current practice where the academies are billing for a third-party reimbursement. Going back to the actual bill, Article 5, Section 1, we have language dealing with all-day kindergarten, and page 36, lines 26 through 30, is providing a definition of full-day kindergarten, meaning an academic program that prepares pupils to enter first grade the following year, provides a minimum of 850 hours in a school year, that's 5 hours a day for 170 days, and aligns with academic standards. What we're trying to do in part here is to clarify what is all-day kindergarten versus what is a part-day kindergarten combined with a school-age care program. Over the past several years, school districts have been a little bit creative in terms of what's full-day kindergarten, what's school-age care. The current statute prohibits fees for all-day kindergarten, but school districts have been charging fees for all-day kindergarten and basically claiming that in terms of their accounting structure as part-day kindergarten and part-day school-age care. We think it's undermining the UFAR system, the state accounting system, because in some cases we have all-day kindergarten being reported in the general fund. In other cases, we have all-day kindergarten being reported in the community service fund. So it's hard to make accurate comparisons between the expenditures for school districts. And what this would try to do is just to put in statute what school districts are essentially doing now, which is to provide full-day kindergarten and charge a fee for it. So part of that is to define first what full-day kindergarten means, and then secondly an amendment to the fee law.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, does this clarify that legal ambiguity that we've been concerned about for the last few years about the fee law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm sorry. Mr. Nauman, we think that this does try to clarify that. It's this section, but also the following two sections. So okay. The first section is setting that up by defining more clearly what full-day kindergarten is. And there is an amendment to this section as well. And that's on page 5 of the amendment, and it's clarifying the accounting for full-day kindergarten to say that revenues and expenditures for full-day kindergarten must be accounted for in the school district's general fund, and that learning activities provided as part of a community education program are not kindergarten and must be accounted for in the community service fund. We did this after a meeting with the Community Service Association to try to make sure that there was some agreement and some consistent definition here.
Thank you for doing that.
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 2 of the bill is adding full-day kindergarten to the fee law, and it's clarifying that a district can charge a fee for an optional full-day kindergarten program if the district also provides a free kindergarten option for students, and also that a school district cannot charge a student with a disability the cost of providing a free and appropriate public education, so that we're not in conflict with federal special education law. Also, that if a school district does charge a fee for kindergarten, that it must establish a reasonable sliding fee scale. So we're essentially codifying what school districts are doing by, with some creative accounting, moving expenditures that should be in the general fund into the community service fund. This will allow them to actually provide full-day kindergarten, keep it in the general fund where it belongs, and charge a fee for it. So it has the same effect as what we're currently doing, but it would allow for a more straightforward accounting practice so that we can provide accurate comparisons of what school districts are spending across the state.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about this language because in giving the mandate to the schools to provide full-day kindergarten for free and appropriate public education for children with disabilities, what is the cost associated with that? And how do we pay for it?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, this is not a mandate. This is an optional program. And currently the funding for students with a disability that are enrolled in kindergarten, and some of them are in full-day kindergarten currently, is funded with a combination of special education funding, both state and federal, and also those students are currently eligible for general education funding as well. And in fact, with special education students, if they require a full-day kindergarten, then they're counted as a full pupil unit, where in the case of general education students, we're only funding up to the 0.612 of a pupil unit. So we do actually provide full general education funding for these students currently, as well as providing the federal and state special education aid. And this is simply clarifying that districts would continue to do that, but not charge a fee for the cost of special education, which would violate federal special education law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Section 3 is amending the list of fees that cannot be charged to include the exception for the fee that's being added here in Section 2. In Section 4,
Section 4, Mr. Chair, in regard to adult basic education supplemental service grants, these are grants that are about $800,000 that are given out. And right now, the minimum or the maximum amount of grant that can be given out is $100,000. It was proposed that they be able to that our department be able to give up to 25% of whatever the amount was, which would be about $200,000. I had some concerns about whether that might limit the number of grants that we would be able to give out. I suggested 15%, which is about $126,000. We are, you know, having discussions with the Minnesota Literacy Council, and we really need to go back to our ABE person who's not able to be here tonight to ask some additional questions about who might not be eligible, who would be eligible, how it would affect maybe outstate areas who would be interested in these grants, to make sure that they would be distributed in an equitable way so that we had representation statewide. So we have 15% right now. The request was 25%. So I just want to put that on the table that this might change or it might stay the same, but we want to get some more clarification actually from our own staff about who has been currently getting the grants and making sure that we're doing this fairly.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. It is my understanding that this needs to go up to 25%, and we do have some members. I'm going to be offering an amendment, some legislation to really look into this equation, because it is my understanding that with the current limitation of 15%, you will not have enough to provide statewide services right now, because the amount of money is just too limiting. Would like to see if we have time we can talk a little bit more about it, because there has been, I think we've done some estimations about the need for meeting the statewide requirements, and apparently this number is just too low.
Let's see. Well, Commissioner, I believe you said you're in discussions now with various stakeholders, and what we wanted to do tonight was to get the issues out on the table. We have time perhaps for some brief testimony from proponents on that issue. We could put that on the record, but I'd like to process any further amendments in the daylight. And so we can take a bit of testimony on that right now, but we would, since this is not a something that needs a little more discussion, would wait on the actual amendment, but we could take some testimony for the record.
Mr. Chair, Section 5, as real quick, if we could just take that real quick before testimony, and then we'll be done with the bill. Section 5 changes the amount the commissioner can reimburse for a GED test from $20 to $40 for an eligible individual. As you may know, over the years, the cost of the test has increased, but we've never increased the 60% threshold. So this, which is in the statute in line 30, so we're allowing the commissioner authority to reimburse eligible individuals a higher amount, up to $40.
Okay. Thanks. And we'll take testimony on the point on raising the amount. And the amendments we've taken thus far has been where there's been consensus with the department and with the members, and we're operating under that trust level, and that's so we aren't going to entertain any other, recognizing that they wanted to do some additional discussion, though there will be that opportunity. But just to further provide some info on that subject.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Nessheim. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Literacy Council. And I thank the committee for its past support, and thank you for hearing us tonight as well. I'm also representing Literacy Minnesota, which is the statewide professional organization for adult basic education, made up of programs all over the state, and practitioners and programs. My agency is one of the providers of supplemental services that you were talking about. And I wanted to give a little bit of background on that. I'll just be as brief as I possibly can.
1 minute total.
Okay, great. And I appreciate the department looking into this as well. Our concern is that this is something that Literacy Minnesota has put forth in a platform, raising this to 125%, basically because when this initially was set in place many years ago, the cap was $100,000 essentially. And we've moved along the